The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 77 for November 8th, 2006. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton. Hi, John. How are you?
Hey, Dave. Yeah, we're a bit late here.
We are.
Various
scheduling.
And we had to observe Election Day, of course.
That's right. But we wouldn't have done the podcast on Election Day anyway. I tell you, things sound strange to me. My my ultimate ears, the ones I usually use for while recording the show, I had to send them into the shop because they're making me a new set and they couldn't get the fit right. So they said, well, we'll just send in the old ones and we'll, you know, match that. But I'm using these Westone UM2s and they're good earphones, but they're wacky sounding compared to my ultimate ears. I heard the band kick in there with the tune and it was like, uh-oh, I have no idea.
Wacky.
Yeah, well, it just, you know, it's different. Anyway.
Wild and wacky?
What's that? Did you say vaudeville?
All right. No, I said wild and wacky.
Wild
because your
and
head
wacky.
Changed shape. I mean, your ears, have they changed? Whatever, go
no,
on.
No. They're making me a new set of, the Ultimate Ears is making me a set of these triple driver things that, purple and yellow, they look cool. Anyway, so we have a whole lot of stuff to go through. As you may have seen today, on the 8th, Apple introduced the new MacBook, the updated MacBook, which, among other things, features the Core 2 Duo chip, just like the MacBook Pro. And that dovetails perfectly in with what we had planned for the show tonight anyway. We had a comment last week from one of you, James, talking about how we hadn't yet really touched on the whole 32 versus 64-bit thing with the Core versus Core 2 Duo. And so John took it upon himself to do all sorts of research on your behalf, and we're going to go through a lot of that tonight and see if we can't figure this whole 64-bit thing out, because it's clearly not clear. And then we've got some other feedback and, you know, the typical stuff, because we're here. Like I said to John before we started the show, this one's either going to be great or it's not. What's that?
Or not so great.
Or not so great. So, this whole 64-bit thing, let's jump right into it. So, the Core Duo is technically a 32-bit chip, and the Core 2 Duo is a 64-bit chip, or at least that's how the marketing speak reads. What does that really mean, John? What's the difference? Let's talk about that first, between 32 and 64-bit processing in general, I guess, and then.
And you know, that's a great question.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the term's been tossed around quite a bit and used in different contexts. And
perfect.
And that's the thing that's really confusing. So, you know, to get to the very basics, a bit is the basic information, one or zero, that your computer can represent, of course. And we started, you know, back with the, I think the first processor was a 4004 from Intel.
Okay.
It was 4 bits, so, you know, 2 to the 4th. Then, you know, like our favorite, the 6502, which was in our Apple, that was an 8-bit. And so, you know, as technology progresses, you get more bits, which is basically the amount of information that the processor, well, what do we mean by that? And I'm going to talk about one definition that a lot of people agree on.
Okay.
Is the bit of a processor is the number of bits that it can handle in one operation. We'll say a lot of times, especially if you're talking compilers that build software, it's the size of the word, or usually an integer.
Okay.
So, you know, 8-bit, 32, 64, however many bits, and we can keep going, and they're always a power of 2, just because that's really easy for computers to do. So, one aspect is, you know, can the chip handle, for, you know, computations and stuff, this number of bits in one operation?
Okay.
And as I mentioned, you progress through, you know, depending on where you are in the timeline on processors, they get more and more bits.
Okay.
The current round, for the most part, well, let's talk about, for example, like I have my PowerBook G4. G4, mm-hmm. That's a 32-bit processor, which nothing wrong with that.
Okay.
When they went to the G5, that is a 64-bit processor.
Right. That's right. Now, yeah, and that, you know, that I'm going to interrupt here, because that's a very good thing to remember. These Core 2 Duos and the Xeon that's in the Mac Pros are not the first 64-bit chips that we've seen in a Mac. The G5, if correct me if I'm wrong, but the G5 was the first 64-bit chip that we saw in a Mac, correct?
With the potential to do all sorts of wonderful 64-bit things, and other vendors, the DEC Alpha, and I believe it was a 64-bit chip, and other chips have, done 64-bits. The IBM and the G5 were not the first.
Okay.
But I'd say, the first, widely available in a consumer class machine.
So you say wonderful 64-bit things. What's an example of a wonderful 64-bit thing?
And here's where the definition gets kind of weird. And I'll have to take a little swipe at Apple for this, because even in Tiger, they say you can develop 64-bit applications. And the one line, I'm looking at their webpage now, what they say, and I have an issue with this, and they say, by definition, the difference between 32-bit computing and 64 is that you can address 64 bits worth of memory.
Okay.
Now, if you look at 32 bits worth of memory, that is at most 4 gigabytes. Which should ring, which some people may say, gee, I've heard of that figure before.
Well, okay, so with 32 bits, with a 32-bit processor, I cannot put more than 4 gigs of RAM in my computer. Is that right?
it's the amount that it can talk to at once easily.
Okay. Can I go off on a little tangent here?
Because absolutely.
Because this reminds me of, again, back to our Apple II days, where, you had a 2E, I believe, and I had a 2C, and they both had 128K, not megs, not gigs, of RAM, but could only see 64K at a time. Is that this whole 8-bit issue? Is that what's going on here?
No, not really. Well, back with the Apple II, the thing was is that you had an 8-bit processor, 64K at any one time.
At any one time, right. Right.
What they did was, which I think they even called it page flipping. So
that's right.
You would have ages where the processor really only knew about 64-bit at any one time, but you could define multiple ones.
Like, I remember
I'm sorry. 60.
Yeah. I want to make sure we get that distinction.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, so one trick you can do is you can take the maximum space of the processor, which could be 16, 32, however many bits, and replicate that by flipping in and out. And you'd probably involve some virtual memory writing to disk and all that stuff.
Sure.
It really depends. So
okay. So that's what that was, and they found a way around it very easily by, like you said, by page flipping. So
right. So you had a card, and
you couldn't have one application spanning, or one block, shall I say, spanning both pages. There had to be two separate things in the pages. Now, I mean, you could get creative and store, what you needed in one page and then another thing, but you couldn't just have one continuous block of memory that was larger than 64K addressable at any one time.
Processor was aware of at any one time at the very lowest level of the processor.
Got it. Okay. I thought that, at least for me, that was a good way of kind of wrapping my head around what that means. So with the 32-bit processor, I'm stuck, because in my MacBook Pro rather, I've got the Core Duo, so I'm stuck with this 4 gigabyte limit. But of course, that doesn't matter, because I can only put 2 gigs of RAM in my computer anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and to go back, the thing is that usually, in almost all cases, the maximum size of data that the processor can deal with and the memory address space are the same, just because it's kind of convenient.
Right, right.
To make them the same. You can certainly play around, and I think even at the lowest levels, the PowerPC does some interesting stuff where, you can... We won't get too deep into it, because it's a complex topic. We want to make it simple. So suffice to say, the amount of data that the processor can talk to and the memory space, let's assume that they're the same.
Okay, fine. Fine. Okay, but I'm going to ask another stupid question, because I know it. If it's on the tip of my mind, well, let's hope it's on the tip of somebody else's. What if I don't have 4 gigs of memory? Does it matter that I've got a 32-bit processor? Right.
I would say not. And that.
I guess, like you said, virtual memory sort of takes over for that, but. If I'm not addressing that, if I don't have that much data to address at any one point in time, does it matter?
I would say probably not.
Okay. All right.
So, if you don't need that much data, now there is a layer above it, which you and I, we kind of tossed around here. So even though the processor may understand how to talk to that much data and address that much data, there's a layer above the processor, the chipset, the BIOS, the firmware,
yep,
whatever you want to call it, it may introduce some limitations for whatever reason, either
right,
cost or complexity. And I think you noted this with some of the newer processors, is that, you know, they cannot address the full space that you would expect them to.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's this whole issue with what's called the Santa Rosa chipset, and I believe it exists only in the, it doesn't exist in the Mac Pro, but it is in the iMac, the Core 2 Duo iMac, the Core 2 Duo MacBook Pro, and now presumably the Core 2 Duo MacBook, where it only, and this is why the MacBook Pro has this 3 gigabyte RAM limitation, because this chipset can't, it can address more than 3, it can address 4, but sometimes it's going to confuse things and assign the same address space to things that are greater than once you move beyond that 3 gigabyte limit, it may try to put the same thing, two things in the same place, and that's bad. So that's why that 3 gigabyte limit is there. So really you have the 64 bit in the processor, but the chipset of the MacBook Pro anyway, and presumably the MacBook, doesn't truly support it. Is that basically what we found here?
Yeah, so the chipset may introduce a limitation for whatever reason. Yeah, so you may not necessarily. I don't know if about the duplicate thing. I'd have to think about that a bit. But there are reasons sometimes where the amount of memory that the processor should be able to address is limited by another chipset above it.
Got it.
Sometimes you get designs where they, will design for the future. So even though the current memory technology may be a certain size,
sure,
they may want to over-design the BIOS, the firmware, whatever, to when the newer chips come out, usually introduce more address lines that they can talk to them. I've seen, especially on, and you've probably seen this too, on some inexpensive PCs, they will design the BIOS or whatever chipset. So even if you put in bigger chips, it doesn't know about it because there's that chipset or BIOS.
Yep.
That was designed, okay, you're only going to understand this much memory. So
that's right.
So this is where you get the layering thing, and this is where it gets complex.
Okay, yeah. So it's not the chip isn't the only thing that matters. You've got the chip, then the chipset, and we'll just kind of roll the whole motherboard into that chipset for the purposes of this discussion. And then on top of that, you've got the operating system.
Of course. So you have the software, which is a compiler.
Right.
And the compilers, now what they don't do typically is that when they do make a progression from one architecture to another larger one, you know, in the PC world, the Mac world, so you go from 16-bit to 32 to 64, they don't make it so that the processor will not understand the software that's designed for the original. So a 64-bit processor, including the PowerPC, it'll run 32-bit code.
Of course.
It may run it better than a 32-bit version.
Really?
Or it may not.
Okay.
And it's hard to say.
Okay.
And I showed you that benchmark that I found today, which would indicate that sometimes it makes matters worse.
Okay. And we'll link to that, right? That was on geekpatrol.ca, and we've got a link for that in the show notes.
Yeah, they have something called Geekbench, which does benchmarks on multiple platforms. And in a nutshell, at least when I ran it on my G5, the results for the 64-bit code were slower. Well, isn't that weird? Well, I'd almost have to say it's a compiler issue.
Got it. Yeah.
Generating code that's optimized for a 64-bit architecture. Because then you have, as you pointed out, or you were hinting at, all these other layers, including the OS.
Right.
You're typically not going to write an application from scratch in assembler, handcrafting it. You're going to take
Not since the Apple II days, no.
Right. And I remember we used to do that.
Oh, yeah.
But you typically either rely on the capabilities of the compiler or the built-in routines, more often than not, if you want your software to behave, the routines built into the operating system. And for example, in Tiger, they advertise 32-bit address space. They're kind of fuzzy about 64-bit address space, but they're kind of fuzzy on 64-bit anything else.
Okay.
And in Leopard, they will be introducing greater capabilities where more parts of the operating system know what 64-bits means.
Got it.
And it's rewritten to target it. So that's where I have a little issue with them saying 64-bit computing is here. It's like, well, yeah, as far as how much memory you can talk to, I'll agree. As far as fully utilizing the capability of a processor, it can do more work in the same amount of time with bigger data, and that's the thing too.
That's the key right there. Is the processor can do, in theory, it can it can, is it right to say it can do twice as much work in the same amount of time?
Well, it depends on the work.
Okay.
It depends. And I have a very good article here, you know, from the IBM folks about the PowerPC. And
okay,
depending on what you're doing, if you're doing a lot of heavy math that involves big numbers,
yep,
or things like that, well, yeah, sure, because you can deal with twice as much data in,
sure,
in the same amount of time.
Got it.
But if you're
okay
doing things like, especially like, and this is where I think you had a question for me, does it really matter?
Right.
It's like, it depends on what you're doing. If you're running a word processor,
Yeah, sure.
Before bit computing is probably not a priority for you unless you're, you know, chugging. I mean, right, if you're just typing and laying things out.
Yeah, but if you're doing a lot of graphics stuff, maybe some gaming or audio processing, you know, where you've got some, you know, internal stuff where you, you know, adding reverb and compression and, you know, all that stuff at the same time, I can see that being hugely advantageous to do it on a 64-bit chip, right?
And that's where they point out the definite advantages of a 64-bit is you can, in theory, depending on what you're doing, but you can do twice the amount of work that you could do with the 32-bit system.
As long as
especially
it's the
as
right
you pointed
work
out.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you're doing... So I would say it's safe to say anything that gets your processor up to 100% or close to it,
yep,
would indicate to me that it's really struggling or trying to do mathematical or other operations, and it's starting to hit a wall. So I would think those apps would benefit greatly. And, you know, again, it depends. I mean,
sure,
Word is probably not going to be chewing up a lot of your processor or text editor.
Right.
But
although Word does quite a bit of graphics display, right? I mean, as you're typing, it's laying out all the fonts and all that stuff. So
now, of course, that even gets to another level of, as you pointed out in the past, an entire system. Then
that's
you have the whole graphics system, the amount of graphic memory, the graphic bus.
And how efficient is the OS? Is it handing off the things that it should be handing off, et cetera, et cetera? Yeah. Okay.
Whew.
All right. Well, that's good.
That pegged the geek meter.
It did. It pegged the geek meter, but I really didn't do any research on this. I mean, I had a general understanding. I read some of the emails that went back and forth, but once we decided to do this for the show, I specifically didn't want to do any research because I wanted to make sure I asked the right questions. And at this point, I feel like I understand this topic better. So thank you, John, for doing all the work. And hopefully the mix here did the right thing for you, the listener, because we're really trying to convey this what I always like to say, we try to translate this to human. So to revisit my own question that I posed to the both of us in the show we did about the MacBook Pro, should, you know, does it matter Core Duo versus Core 2 Duo? And knowing, you know, what I know now, I guess for some folks it does. Like you said, if you're pegging your processor, if you're doing a lot of, graphics work or audio work or the kinds of things that, frankly, you know, the Mac excels at, this 64-bit thing is going to make a difference. So, yeah, I may modify my advice and say, yeah, for it matters more to some of us than others.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to point to the Geek Patrol thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what they noted is that with the code that they compiled with whatever compiler they used, which I don't know if it was Xcode or another GCC, or, well, Xcode does have GCC last I checked. The Intel code, when they ran the 32-bit version of their benchmark and the 64-bit targeted for a 64-bit,
yep,
on the Intel chip, it did better.
Huh.
On the G5, it did worse, which hints to me that the
compiler
knew how to produce more efficient code for one processor versus the other.
Got it. Okay.
So that's where I get to the thing that, you know, a lot of it is, it depends. If the compiler knows how to do the code and the chip and the chipset and the memory and everything, if everybody all knows about 64-bit,
then rocks.
You could rock. Otherwise, it could actually get worse.
Okay. Got it. All right. Well, that's it. Please do. I'm sure. I mean, we've really hung it out here on the line. So I'm sure we've gotten some things wrong. I'm sure we glossed over. I know we glossed over some stuff that is going to that already has graded some of you the wrong way. That's okay. I wanted to get this conversation started, By no means would this necessarily be the end of it. Please feel free to send in your audio comments, your emails. You know, let the floodgates open. 206-666-GEEK is the number to call if you want to phone in an audio comment. You can Skype it to MacGeekGab or MacGeekGab@MacObserver.com. And I believe Andy, we're moving on to some follow-ups from our Keyboard Shortcut show, because there seems to be a lot of them this week. And Andy actually called that 206-666-GEEK, which, for those of you without numbers on your phone, is 206-666-4335. And Andy had this to say.
Hi there, guys. This is Andy from Germany. I'm calling or sending in this audio comment about Robert's dictionary question, looking up dictionary question. I think it was in episode 76 or something like that. What I did was I went to System Preferences and Keyboard and Mouse, and then clicked on a tab, Keyboard Shortcuts, and in that list there is an option for the dictionary, or much rather, look up in the dictionary. And I assigned, in my case, a key F4 to it, as I assigned the keys F1, 2, and 3 for Exposé and various on Dashboard. That enables me to toggle on and off the dictionary option, and I thought that's a neat feature that I thought I'd like to share with you guys. Keep up the good work. Love the show. And bye.
Thanks, Andy. And of course, there's no way Andy called the number. He recorded that on his own Mac. That sounded way too clear. But thank you very much. And Donald, remember, it's by default, it's Command Control D to do this dictionary thing. But mm-hmm. as Andy found, that shortcut is available to be modified in the keyboard shortcut section of the system preferences. Donald also wrote in and said that there's a couple of other ways that you can look up a word in the dictionary. And you can go into Safari and by typing dict colon, D-I-C-T, colon, slash, 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 and a word, you'll get the dictionary entry right there, and you can even email that to other people. Presumably they need to be Mac users, but that's yet another one. This dictionary thing has been so cool that I wind up using it more than I thought I would. There's a couple of the shortcuts from that keyboard shortcut show that I just use almost all the time. The Command L in iTunes to locate the existing playing track is great, because I wind up surfing all around in there and then get lost, and it brings me right back to the playlist where I started from and all that stuff. And then this dictionary thing. So I figured the dictionary thing would be the first TeachMac module that I created. As you know, TeachMac is a sponsor of the show for a long-term sponsor anyway, and at TeachMac.com, of course. And their program is built to have examples, audio, still picture, or audio and video together, showing training people to do certain things. And I created a TeachMac module this afternoon. It took me all of about 6 minutes to do. Very, very easy. I actually wound up using Snaps Pro and recorded a movie just of me on the screen, and I was just talking into the mic in front of my Mac, and showing how to use this dictionary thing, and it worked great. So that module will be in the Mac Geek Gab section at TeachMac, and you can submit your own modules to TeachMac using their Module Maker app. I swear it's easy, very, very simple to use. So TeachMac.com, and we thank them for sponsoring the show and also offering this great little platform for us to use to get stuff out. So hopefully that'll appear in the TeachMac listing within the next couple of days here.
Yeah, I'd really want to ask you not to swear, though.
Well,
actually, no, I want to mention one thing about dictionary.
Yeah.
A few people wrote, because I was scratching my head saying, how did you find out about this other than the keyboard and the system preferences? And here's what I did. So I got to, explain myself here.
Yeah, go ahead. Explain yourself.
So I went to Dictionary Help. I went to Dictionary Help, and it has a search field, and I typed in keyboard shortcut.
Okay.
I didn't find anything.
Right.
Now, at least in my mind, my expectation was if dictionary had a keyboard shortcut, it would show up.
Well, but here's the defense for that. It's not the dictionary app that's doing that, right? This is an OS function.
Yeah, but I still expect it to know what I want.
I think that's an unreasonable expectation.
But then, as it was pointed out, several people wrote in, if you go to Dictionary Help, you bring it up in the dictionary app, and yeah. then you go to See All Dictionary Topics, and you say, looking up words in other applications. That will clue you in. So I should have taken that path, so I did not take enough time to read through all of the topics, and searching for a keyboard shortcut within the Help app was not the right approach. So just to let people know, it was there, but not where I expected.
All right. So Steve then had to follow up on more keyboard shortcuts. Here's what Steve had to say. This is interesting. You know what? I gotta unmute that channel if there's any hope of hearing what Steve's gonna say. So we'll try that again.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Steve from Seattle again. Great job on the show. I'm calling about the keyboard shortcuts episode. Two things. One is a follow up on a question somebody had. The other is the Uber Geek shortcut of them all. Firstly, somebody asked about the keyboard shortcut for applications. You guys mentioned Spotlight, but neglected to mention the top hit shortcut. So use Spotlight, Command, Spacebar, enter the application name or the first couple of letters, and then your top hit will show in your list up in the upper right corner. And then to select the top list from the keyboard, just click Command and Enter. If your desired application doesn't come up as the top hit, you can go to the Get Info command, edit the Spotlight comments, and add in a couple of characters that you can type, which will always get you that application as the top hit. Your discussion about shortcuts, I think, was missing an important consideration, and that is what makes a shortcut a shortcut.
Uh-huh.
And if you look at novice computer users, generally, I see them have their right hand on the mouse and the left hand sitting in the lap as if it was paralyzed. So that said, I think the best keyboard shortcut is actually your left thumb. And what I do is I keep my left thumb on the keyboard right about the Command spacebar. And I can use the spacebar for paging down web pages. Command key is right there in combination with the forefinger. I've got everything, Command tab, quit, close, refresh, select all, copy paste, Command Z, all of that's right there in an instant that I want it. And I think that's the best shortcut. Cheers, guys. Keep up the great work. Talk to you later.
All right, that actually hits on a topic that is near and dear to my heart. So thank you, Steve, for mentioning that. You're right. The left hand is oft unused. In fact, when I was starting, I was working, doing a lot of graphic design back for Citibank in the days, and I found myself with my left hand paralyzed, of course, in my desk, in my lap, and my right hand, I watched it one day as I bounced from the mouse to the keyboard, I was doing a lot of stuff in PageMaker and things like that where, you know, you had to do some commands and then move things around and do some commands. And I thought, well, this is stupid. And the problem is I could type, and still can, type a lot better one-handed with my right hand than my left hand. So I reasoned, okay, well, that's not going to change anytime soon. However, I can teach myself how to use the mouse with my left hand. So I did that. And the first day I was a total spaz, but I actually brought out the application ShufflePuck, which some of you may remember from days gone by, which was essentially like playing air hockey on the Mac, but you use the mouse to control the little air hockey thing. And it was a perfect way to totally lose the sight of the fact that I was using my left hand and just focus on this game. Developed the hand-eye coordination, took about a day, and then started using the mouse with my left hand and had my right hand to dance all over the keyboard. And it was amazing how fast my productivity increased. Awesome. So, so there you go.
What I toss in, two things. One, take a typing course.
Oh, well, yeah. Sure.
If you haven't already.
Yeah, but that doesn't help you one-handed, right? I mean, that, you know, they usually don't teach you how to type one-handed.
So, of course, yeah. So, number one, learn to touch type because you may have to type in the dark someday.
Right.
But the other thing is, well, my favorite input device, and I have it both at the, you know, day job and at home, and I got hooked on them like over 10 years ago, was the Turbo Mouse.
Yep.
And that, at least the current one that I have right now, the USB one, has 6 shortcut buttons, and it has 4 buttons itself, and then the trackball. And I've just gotten very used to this. That's why any computer that I use, you know, on a regular basis, yeah. I like to have one of these. And it also introduces, you know, a certain level of shortcuts because it has four buttons. I'm so glad Steve got over the one-button mouse thing.
Oh, yes, thank goodness. That wasn't working out too well.
One-button mouse.
That's not how we roll here, Steve. We got multiple-button mice.
Yeah, well, the thing is that, you know, a one-button mouse, the only thing I can agree with is the chance of hitting the wrong button is 0%.
That's true. Or it's 100%.
Well, there is no other button to press on the mouse.
Oh, yeah,
well, so.
I guess that's true. But the one button could be, at a certain time, the wrong button, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
You know, if you're hovered over the OK chiclet when it says, are you sure you want to erase this drive, right? Then that might be the wrong button, despite the fact that it's the only button. So it's situational, situational reference there. So, I wanted to follow up. Chuck from randomaccess.com wrote in and said he knew the solution because he had the same problem to the issue of that one of our listeners had a couple of shows ago, where plugging the iPod into the front USB port on the dual processor G5 ground the machine to a halt. And Chuck had the same problem with his daughter's iPod. He went back and forth to the Apple store, actually got a new iPod, same problem, then plugged it into the back, and sure enough, it worked just fine. After knowing this, he then did some searches online and found that, yes, this is a known but not addressed problem where there's some issues with the front USB ports, or at least the way they're addressed, or something along those lines. So if you do have that problem with the dual G5, that's the answer.
Which I have one of those. And actually, I was doing a bit of fooling around, too. Yeah. I thought that there may have been a discrepancy between the style of USB on the front and the back, 0 or 2.0. As it turns out, at least on my G5, they're all USB 2.0, 48-bit kilobit ports. Because I thought, you know, if one is a USB 1, then maybe just because it's quite a bit slower than USB 2. So it must be some way that they wire up the USB controller to the front and the back, that one of them is just, the driver's not written right, is my guess.
That may very well be it. So there you go. So that's our catch-up stuff. We got a little bit of time here. We've got a couple of things that we can go through here. We'll start with Chad. Remember, 206-666-GEEK. That's right, 4335.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Chad from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Calling with a question I'm sure you can help me out with. I am now living in Wisconsin. My family, extended family, lives primarily in the suburbs of Chicago, Illinois, which, while only being a two-hour drive, is a bit long of a drive when I get the inevitable phone call, something's screwy with my computer. I have a copy of Apple Remote Desktop, and that works to a point, but there are multiple computers within my parents' house that I need to be able to administer. Right now, my only solution is to first log into their base station, change where the port forwarding for ARD. Well, first I have to somehow get into the base station, find out which IP address the computer I need to administer is, and then route stuff to that machine. Needless to say, it's a big pain in the tushy, and I was hoping for something better. What I'm looking for is some sort of VPN solution where I could put that just on the inside of their network and connect to them. Either that, it could either be hardware or software. I would love to have some sort of software solution I could just install on their primary Mac and then put that on the DMZ and connect in and go from there. Alternatively, I wouldn't mind shelling out some money just so that I don't have to make that drive and put that just inside their network and connect to it. Do you have any hardware or software solutions for a VPN server? Obviously, the base station has a VPN pass-through, but it itself won't do VPN, as far as I know. If you have any solutions, let me know. I'd appreciate it. Otherwise, enjoy the show. Take care. Bye.
All right, Chad. I've got some ideas for you here. The first would be to simply... Now, I'm assuming you're using an airport base station and configuring that to do this may be a little tricky, but you could set it up so that coming in on, you can have it so that when you come into a certain port, presumably 5700, I believe that's the port for VPN, or maybe it's 5701. Actually, I think it's that whole range. So you come in on port 5700 and that points you to a certain Mac. Well, it points you to port 5700 on a certain Mac. You could also do it so that when you go to port 5701, it points you to port 5700 on another Mac. And you can do your port mapping that way and get there. You could also go to the individual Macs and change the port on which the VPN server listens. But that requires editing some stuff at the command line. So so if you can configure the router, and honestly, I simply forget whether... I know it's an option on most of the Linksys and Netgear routers that you can say, look, if I come in on one port, forward me to another Mac or another computer on the network on another port. But the airport base station may force you to route to the port in question. So if you're going to do any of this... Mm-hmm. I recommend doing static mapping. Don't get an IP address from DHCP.
Right.
Get an IP address, assign one manually, pick one that's outside of the range that the DHCP server assigns, and just assign them manually. That way you're sure not to have to guess. However, all this may be maybe more than you want to deal with. You want a VPN in and be done with it. I don't know of a way of doing that with the airport base station. It's not that it's impossible. It's that no one's released software to change the base station and allow this capability. You could, as you said, install a VPN client or a VPN server like OpenVPN on Mac OS X. That would work, but installing that requires more command line headache than you probably want to deal with. Honestly, the solution I recommend is the one that I implement here. Get a Linksys WRT54GS, not the G. And the reason you can't get the G is because they crippled it recently, the version 5 and version 6. Version 5 and version 6 of it only have 8 megs of memory, and it's not enough to do what we want to do. The older versions had 16, and that was fine. The WRT54GS has... used to have 32 megs of memory. Now it only has 16, but that's enough to run DD-WRT, which is a different firmware for the Linksys routers and others. And one of the features that's available in the standard version of this firmware is a VPN server. It's PPTP, very straightforward. It works with OS X's VPN client, and you can set it up and log in and then address all the Macs as if they were on your local network. So that's it. It's not, there's no straight ahead solution, but that's as simple as it gets. The nice part about it is it's all installed on the router. And once you get that, you can set up that router at home, bring it to your parents' house, plug it in, and you're done. So that's DDWRT. Oh. It's free. You buy your router. It's less than $100. You do, what, about $65-$70 for the GS, and you need that GS unless you can find an older G, and then you're fine. So there you go.
I think they had an L, but anyways, it's funny because I actually updated the firmware in my Linksys, and as it turns out, I have a 6.0, and I was just looking here that they definitely did after the 4.0, because I thought it'd be the same, and it's not. They actually reduced the amount of flash memory.
That's right.
They actually came up with an update because I've had some problems with my current one. It's now in version 10, at least on the...
Of the Linksys firmware?
Yeah, actually, I think a month or two ago, they actually updated it because I was having some problems with my latest one. I mean, in general...
You got to give up on that Linksys firmware, man. You got to run DDWRT. You'll be much better off.
Because of my prior one, I think I had a version 2 or 3.
Yeah.
One of the ones that had enough flash to take the new firmware,
right?
I was very happy with that. When I ordered the new one, I assumed that it would be the same.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
Well,
the other problem is they switched to VXWorks.
VXWorks, right. But you can...
Versus a Linux base.
But you can still run DDWRT. You have to run the mini version, which doesn't include the VPN server, but you can run that on your version 5 and 6 routers from Linksys. I'll put a link in the show notes and I'll obviously send it to you, John. There's a page that talks about how to get that firmware on there, and it's not too bad. I just did it for my dad a couple of weeks ago. So
another thought,
yep.
Now I'm going to toss one other out, is you could I think you can do this, either AppleScript or Automator, is to write a little script where when you run it, it resets the static IP of the machine to a known one, like the secret support IP, whatever you want that to be for your... And then when you're done doing that, you have grandma or grandpa or whoever it was, your parents, run something to revert it back to another address. You see where I'm getting at?
I do. Yeah, that way you leave the forwarding in place as he currently has it, or forward it to
a specific port, and then you... I'm pretty sure you could... I'm going to assume you could do that through AppleScript or Automator, where you can change... IP, so I agree with you, and I do this at home too. Any machine that's not moved, that I can't move easily, gets a static IP.
Yeah, and you know, I want to say something about that, and I've been doing this for a while with my laptop. You know, obviously my Mac laptops have two network adapters that I use regularly, the wireless one and the wired one. And you can set the same IP address to both adapters. And the cool thing is, if I'm plugged in wired and I need to go somewhere and I've got a transfer happening, I turn on airport, make sure it's connected to the base station, you know, or the router, unplug the cable, and the transfer never stops. Very cool. If you look in the logs, you'll see that there's some, you know, some fighting that happens, and you got to go in your network system preference pane and change the order so that Ethernet is the top priority. Airport is the second priority, and that way the system knows, you know, if I got Ethernet, I'm not going to send traffic over the airport interface, assuming they're on the same subnet, assuming all else is equal. And it actually works great, and it's been working great since, you know, probably OS 10.0, if not 10.1. So, All right, Dave's got a problem. We're going to fix it for him. Not me. I have a problem too, and I'll talk about that.
Hey, guys. How are you? Great show. This is Dave, and I am calling from the Woodstock, New York vicinity. I just recently developed a little bit of an issue with my PowerBook over the last couple of days. I do a lot of traveling, a lot of flying, and I was in a hotel room. Oh, so the point is that I use my PowerBook on battery quite a bit, and I just recently bought a new battery about a month or so ago, and it's been great. But a couple days ago, I was in a hotel, unplugged it, took my PowerBook with me, went to go do some work for the afternoon, came back, plugged my PowerBook back in again, and the little amber and green lights around the power adapter didn't light up, so I was a little confused with what was happening. However, it was running off the AC, it's just that it wasn't charging the battery, it seems. Every time I unplugged it, the battery life indicator would be lower and lower, and it wasn't taking a charge. So I let the battery run down completely, tried plugging it in again, to no avail. Tried zapping the PRAM, to no avail. And I'm a little bit at a loss what to do. So maybe you guys can help me. It's way out of warranty. It's a 1 gig PowerBook. And we'll take it from there. All right, as usual, as everyone else says, great show. Keep it up. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for the kind words, Dave. I've got a simple answer for you. It's your adapter. Michael, the wonderful gentleman who converts the podcast to AAC for us and all of you, had exactly the same problem. Frankly, I think it was on the PowerBook that I sold to him, and swapped out the adapter and good to go. So one last question, because when I heard this, I decided I wanted the answer too, and I looked and I couldn't find it. And now it's driving me crazy. So thanks, Zoe.
Hi, I have a question about finding downloads. I download a lot of stuff onto my computer and my downloads folder gets full really quickly. I'd really like to make a smart folder that finds, for instance, today's downloads or this week's downloads. Basically, using date created or date modified doesn't usually work because they come with the file itself, rather than being set at the moment that they appear on my computer. What I really need is the equivalent of iTunes date added column. Any tips you can give me and I would be really grateful. I love the show. I listen all the time from Milan, Italy, and keep doing a great job. Thanks.
I don't have an answer on this. John, I know you and I talked about this before the show, and you know, there's no...
It's tough. I saw some smart folder action like an other category, but there was a boatload.
There's a truckload of stuff out there. I dug through that. It doesn't exist. It should. It seems like it could. It, you know, the only thing I can think of is perhaps coming up with, you know, and you'd have to write some script that looked at the folder, took a snapshot of what was there, and then, you know, created aliases to things based on when they were, you know, when they were added. If you had it run as a cron job and it ran every 10 minutes or so, you know, I don't know.
You know, the other thing too, it could just be, you know, she's got to really just, you know, be a bit more organized than just like pay attention to that folder. It's crying out to you to clean it.
I do the same thing. It works. It works. So, you know, I wish I knew the answer.
No, I have the same thing. Every now and then I have a dedicated download folder. Most of the times I'll find it in last modified or towards the top, but every now and then I'm like, where did it go? And I got
a lot of stuff. Anytime you download a disk image or anything that was created, you know, image files, picture files and things like that usually get, you know, the date modified or date added or date created. But a lot of other files, they're just, I had to download the AIM, the old AIM installer the other day, and its date is from 2004. And it's like, you know, I had a hard time finding it because I had,
so
you
this
know,
is the
25 things. My downloads
Mac
folder.
Geek Gab Geek Challenge. Can you figure this
out? Can you do it? This is the Geek Challenge.
All right. Do we have a prize?
Sure. We'll send him some books or something. We've got stuff. Sure. Yeah, send it. Get us the. You get us the answer to that. We'll get you something. How's that sound? Right?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, John? You know, I've got a couple things coming up here. One is that next week, Tuesday, the 14th of November, I will be at the Seacoast Mac Users Group meeting, the Seacoast Mug in Rye, New Hampshire, with Corey Cooper from the Mac OSG podcast. And we're going to be talking about what? Podcasting. So if you are in the New Hampshire area, it is a free meeting. Please come by, say hi. We'll smile or something. So there you go. We'd love to see you there. From what I understand, it's a great group of folks. So I am very much looking forward to doing
that. They're Mac people.
Exactly. There you go.
They got to be decent.
Yeah, absolutely.
And otherwise, we'll beat the living stuffing out of them.
I got another thing I need. If anybody knows of good, easy to use, simple, not too complex project management, you know, Gantt chart package for the Mac, let me know. I need something. There's so much stuff out there, and I've been looking, and I don't know.
You could run Project.
Microsoft
Camp.
Project? Come on, man. Come on. That's not how we roll here. So that's it. Cashfly Hosting, of course, is where you've downloaded this show. Next week, we've got so many listener comments, and I have no doubt that there will be more. So we are going to do the show Monday next week, so it'd be a short gap between now and then.
Yep, and I'll have to say, you know, especially the 3264 thing.
Yeah.
We tried to make it.
Let us have it. There it is.
Well, no, but also I know there's a lot of people that listen, and we got the emails. Thank you so much. You know, that are specialized in compiler design and chip design,
yeah,
and fun stuff like that. And you know, once you get out of that niche, there, it becomes, I think, kind of difficult to describe to a normal person. Which, well, if you're listening to this, you're probably not quite normal. But how do you boil it down? I think it's a big challenge, and I still have some issue with, you know, the marketing angle. You know, what do 64 bits mean to people? Yeah. And I think it's an important topic. And you know, Apple's preparing for it, which is great, with their new chips.
All right. So the podcast marketplace has the 6i Isolator earphones from Edemotic,
awesome,
the A5 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, and of course, TeachMac from TeachMac.com. If you want to sponsor the show, talk to the Backbeat Media Podcast Network, but it's getting full, folks. And play Nation States with us, because it's just so much darn fun, you know.
Screaming Blueberries is your choice
for
Delegate.
There you go. That's what you say.
That's what I say.
That's what you say. Thank you so much for staying subscribed. We really appreciate it. We look forward to talking to you in a couple days. Short gap. Long gap, not good. Short gap, good. So it's the icing on the cake.
Yeah. Well, no, the icing on the cake is the final thing, Dave. Which is?
The final thing? What do you mean the final thing?
You know.
Oh, yes. Very, very important. Don't get caught.
Made up.